You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast at newscast.webcomicbeacon.com.
It's Sunday, May 13th, 2012, and this is episode 68 of the Webcomic Beacon Newscast with, from alexisguide.net, Alex Eberling.
In before shawarma.
And let me welcome aboard Marie Terry, who's been an occasional guest here, but is now joining us as one of our regular commentators. So make sure to stop by her site at evilspacecat.com and welcome her. And someone who needs to work on her timing, Marie Terry.
Yeah. I'm awful, but great.
And I'm Thomas Revor from 910 Comics. That's 910cmx.com. And let's look at the news. Our top story, just like everybody's top story in the comic book world and webcomic world this past couple of weeks, The Avengers. The groundbreaking and phenomenal movie has set an industry record, breaking the previous opening weekend record by $40 million. That's right, it set over $200 million for the first weekend and over an additional $100 million on the second weekend, also breaking a record. And over at Christian Science Monitor, that's csmonitor.com, they have a story over there talking about, is there a message for the industry? That's right. It says that does the initial success of this formula blockbuster, and I disagree with formula, which also flipped the conventional pattern of opening first in the United States and then globally, portend any emerging trend in Hollywood for moviegoers in the foreseeable future. It's a very interesting look at the story, at the way that The Avengers has been handled, especially comparing it to the what it calls a huge disappointment of John Carter, which was a huge loss for Disney. I think between the two of them, I think they actually made a net profit with Avengers. So go ahead and take a look at it and the way that they review Hollywood as handling a lot of the movies and how The Avengers may be changing everything about it. And with that, let's go ahead and go over and take a look at what's in the buzz with Alex. Alex?
Hey, this week in Buzz, first up, we have a story from BrokenFrontier.com about Comixology joining the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund as a corporate member. Comixology is joining other industry leaders like Dark Horse, DC, Diamond, Image, Legendary Comics, Random House, and Threadless as corporate members to support the CBLDF's work of protecting the First Amendment rights of comics and its community of retailers, creators, publishers, librarians, and readers. They say that there is no time present to support the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and we are happy to show our commitment to free speech and the comics industry with this donation. You can check out the whole article at BrokenFrontier.com, as I said. Next up, the 2012 Joe Shuster Award nominees have been announced. The Shuster Award is an award that honors Canadian comics. And there are several categories, artist and artist team, cartoonist, cover artist, and there's a webcomic creator or creative team category. And the nominees in that group are Jade 8 Cassie, Emily Carroll, Tony Cliff, Kate Craig, Iris and Zvian, Drazen Kozian, and Ty Templeton. And that is over at comicsbeat.com, where you can read more about the Shuster Award and the other nominees in the other categories. And next, lastly, actually, in Buzz, from knowledgetoday.upenn.edu and beacon.wharton.upenn.edu, there are two articles exploring kind of the same thing about the Avengers and the Marvel movies, creating a new method of storytelling. Now, for folks who have been familiar with print comics and otherwise, this sort of thing is not really new to you. The idea that, you know, instead of sort of standalone stories and one-offs, you know, comics have been sort of crossovering and cameos and, you know, shared stories like the Avengers, you know, since the 40s. And so it kind of speculates that maybe the movies will go the same way. And you can read those articles over on UPenn. And I'll take it over to Marie for the people.
Thanks, Alex. Got two stories in People Today. The first one, a little bit sad, from WashingtonPost.com and Robot6.comicbookresources.com. Maurice Sendak, who is probably best known for his children's book Where the Wild Things Are, but also did a variety of others, over 100, I believe, as the Washington Post article comments on, has died. And he was well known for transforming children's literature from being a sort of gentle playscape into something a little more dark and intense, and very powerful, often surreal, introducing a very powerful and often darkly surreal vision to the literary genre of children's books. He was a very prolific writer, and I'm sure that most of us grew up with Where the Wild Things Are, and he will be profoundly missed. If you'd like to know more about his career and about his accomplishments, do feel free to check out the articles and read them on the links in the show notes. The second one is a little bit more upbeat, is a... we have a review of book Poor Craft, which is by Spike and Diana Nock. And it is a book on how to basically make better use of your resources in this tight time. If you're like me and many other people, you're having to be a little more careful with your wallet and dollars and cents these days. And Poor Craft, the funny book, Fundamentals of Living Well on Less, is now available for you to peruse. And it will drop on May 20th, 2012. So it was done by Spike, who's best known for her Twin Peaks-esque webcomic Templar AZ. And apparently it's very well done, very well organized, with a lot of research and great philosophic quips and funny all around on all different areas of life: housing, food, clothing, health, transportation, education, emergencies, entertainment. It covers everything. So it sounds like it's be a really good read. So it's definitely worth checking out. If you'd like to read a more comprehensive review, do please check out the article on Comic Talks. I think that's where it is on Comic Talks. Yeah, Comic Talks, comicstalk.com. And the link is in the show notes. So I believe we're back to you, Tom.
Thank you. I saw the title of Poor Craft, and I immediately thought it was How to Write Comics by Dan DiDio.
Wah, wah, wah.
We'll be back with more news and hopefully some actual humor right after this.
The Geek Life Podcast is, get this, a discussion of all things geek. Technology, movies, television, books, comics, games, nothing is off limits. Join Mike, Paul, Richard, and Melissa at The Geek Life Podcast at thegeeklife.tv.
Welcome back to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. I'm your host, Thomas Refor, and let's go ahead and bring it over for our business look with Marie Terry again. Marie.
Thanks, Tom. Two items in business today. First one, Marvel Comics inks a deal with Comixology on single issue releases. Digital, of course. This comes to us from blog.newsock.com and bleedingcool.com. Apparently, Marvel Comics and Comixology have announced in a news release that English language single issue digital comics will go on sale exclusively through Comixology. It includes such titles as Avengers, X-Men, Spider-Man, and many more. Apparently, the content will be available via the Marvel apps for all the various OSs, Apple, iOS, Android, Kindle Fire, and on Comixology.com. And they will also be available through Comixology's digital storefronts for brick-and-mortar retailers. And you will find a list of the digital storefronts and more information on blog.newsock.com or on Bleeding Cool. So go ahead and check out the links. Our second piece of business news, Ruben Bowling. I hope I said that right. Bowling? I can't get names.
Bowling.
Bowling. Yes. Don't give me names. Anyway, launches Inner Hive. So Ken Fisher, a.k.a. Ruben Bowling, has announced that he is creating something called the Inner Hive to fans of his comic Tom the Dancing Bug. Apparently, this is a private email program that will include advanced comics, contests, and giveaways to people who subscribe to it for $9.99 for 6 months. So that's $9.99 for 6 months, basically 10 bucks for 6 months. And apparently Tom the Dancing Bug was originally conceived as a newspaper strip, and it's very more popular, but the financial viability because of the syndicate situation and stuff has gone down. So he's trying to see if his subscriber or his fans are interested in more. So if you want to check out more of it, there's at thedailycartoonist.com is where this is from. And there's a link down in the show notes and you can check it out and see what you think. Back to you, Tom.
Thank you, Marie. Let's go take a look at some of the stuff in the tech news today. We're going to start off with our friend Sean Kleefeld over at MTV, geek-news.mtv.com, talking about the broadening base of webcomics, primarily mentioning the recent release of Thrillbent by longtime comic creator, writer, and all-around good guy Mark Waid, and how this is going to be reflecting upon the webcomic industry itself, along with the review as to not just Thrillbent and Waid himself. There are a couple of chime-ins from other webcomic people, such as Scott Kurtz of PvP and DJ Kaufman, occasional guest here at the Webcomic Beacon newscast. Of course, what Kurtz says is always makes for interesting news, so go ahead and we'll cover that. I'm sure we'll be talking about this after the during our discussion portion. Next up is an interview with Ted Adams, the CEO and president of IDW Publishing. Talking about many things, but included in that is how they are augmenting their sales with digital publishing. That's right. More of a kudos to the digital publishing realm given by a professional, quote-unquote, comic company, the print company. Third news, the Netherlands cements their net neutrality in law. Over at slash.org, slash.org, we have a story saying that a while back, Dutch telcos have started singing the "We Are Losing Money Due to Internet Services" song and floated plans that would make consumers pay extra for data used by apps that conflicted with their own service. The politicians stepped in and wrote laws forbidding this. These have been passed through the Senate in the Netherlands, and now they are a net neutral country, the second in the world, only being preceded by Chile. And finally, also at slashdot.org, a story dealing with the eventual collapse of the social networks. That's right, they're talking about how services like Facebook and Twitter and all the rest of these are going to be dying out. So go ahead and take a look at those stories. We'll have more of that in the show notes. And now let's go ahead and take a look at our tidbits with Alex.
This week in tidbits, first off, the Comic Book Legal Defense is looking for website contributors. Over on comicbooks.com, they posted, the CBLDF is looking for contributors to add to our roster of bloggers. Each member of our website team will be asked to identify or generate content about relevant free speech issues for the website on a weekly or semi-weekly basis. The position is voluntary. If you're interested in that, head over to cbldf.org to put in an application. And now, over on comicspeak.com and bleedingcool.com, Shifty Look, a Namco and Bandai venture, is resurrecting long-ago console video games as webcomics. And they just announced another series, based on Dig Dug. They've assembled an all-star cast of webcomickers, including, Joey Esposito, Jerry Holkins and Mike Krahulik, Scott Kurtz, David Melke, Randy Milholland, all sorts of people, to create their own takes on the Dig Dug in comic form. And it looks like it'll be sort of an anthology webcomic, as far as I can tell, and additional contributors and collaborators are to be announced, so there's even more than the long, long list of people that they already have contributing to this. So you can check that out. And that's it for tidbits.
And I guess that brings it back to me for a look at our oddities. We're going to go ahead and start off over at bleedingcool.com again. They have the Avengers yearbook photos, but not quite what you'd think. This isn't teenage pictures of Captain America, Thor, Iron Man, the rest of them. This is the teenage pictures of the actors who are in the blockbuster movie. That's right. And I gotta say, I love the mullet on Hawkeye. So, go ahead and take a look at them. See how geeky some of these people really look back when they were teenagers. Makes the rest of us look a little bit better. And finally, over on The Economist, TheEconomist.com has discovered webcomics. This is a story that we've talked about numerous times, and one of the larger and mass media have discovered that, hey, there's this thing called the internet, and they have comic stories on it. There's actually something other than porn here. So go ahead and take a look over it. We'll have that over on TheEconomist.com. And we'll be discussing that along with many of other things that we've talked about here on the news right after this.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter for news links as we find them at WebcomicZ. Email us at webcomicbeaconnews@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We're also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
And welcome back to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. It's time for our discussion panel. And with me, I'd like to welcome board Marie Terry.
Hello.
And the host of Animation Aficionados, Ben Carver.
Hello.
And of course, I'm your host, Thomas Revoir from 910 Comics. It's 910cmx.com. Point one for our discussion today is the story that we had from Sean Clayfield about the broadening base and the introduction with Thrillbent. Thrillbent from Mark Waid has gotten a lot of attention in both the webcomic, comic, and general news because of it being one of the names in comic books reaching out and becoming a member of the webcomic community. We've talked a lot about it over the past few weeks, but this time, let's add a little bit of fuel to the fire. Our friend over at PvP, Scott Kurtz, surprise, surprise, actually has something to say about it. Kurtz has told everyone last week, quote, "This is something I've been warning my friends in webcomics about for a while now, that eventually someone famous from the comic book industry would figure out that they should try to do what we've been doing for the last 15 years or so and would follow suit. If Mark can make Thrillbent stick, then everything changes. Everyone up to this point has been too scared to follow us. And if Mark Waid makes Thrillbent work, they're coming very soon."
I didn't think Phil Folio was too scared.
Nope, and there have been others in the comic industry that have been coming over. I know a number who have been sticking their toe in the water because it gives them a lot of the freedom that they don't have with the major publishers. They are their own editor, they're on their own writer. They can do their own projects without someone telling them how it should be done, without losing control of it. I mean, the whole, especially with the recent news stories on Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster's battles against Warner Brothers on the Superman creation, and of course the ongoing story of Jack Kirby and so many others who have work for hire for Marvel, DC, and others.
I'm just counting on my hands here, and I know lots of professionals that moved into web comics long before this.
And even if there wasn't, I mean, I'm sorry, this is not a zero sum game. The more people who come into web comics, it's only the better for us. Those who have had webcomics for 15 years, yes, we've been doing it for a long time. Bully for us. They've made a name. We've made a name. We've continued on. Having the professionals brings more attention to the webcomics that would not be normally there.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
I can't see how it can be a bad thing other than someone who has a ramrod up their backside. And is, I mean, is so used to being the big fish in the little pond that here comes one of the big fish from the big pond coming along.
Scott Kurtz is a big fish?
In the webcomic world, yes, unfortunately. However,
he's a minnow.
Later on in the article...
Have you ever seen the dude? He is not a minnow.
He's the SS minnow.
No, he ain't.
Later on in the same interview, it mentions that in a comic book reviews interview, Mark Waid credited DJ Kaufman of Hero by Night, another webcomic person,
for providing... Great comic, by the way. I just had to add it in there.
For providing some early help with basic web templates that he just hasn't figured out yet. On his blog, Waid noted that he didn't figure out how to paste a webcomic until he got to the end of Chapter 3 of Insufferable. That's an issue I mentioned, well, Kleefeld mentioned on his blog back in 2007, and he doesn't even write comics. Again, this isn't Mark Waid coming and saying, I'm going to create this new thing called webcomics. He's someone who's been an advocate for webcomics for a while now.
Yeah, and he's just sort of diving in it and discovering that there's a whole new set of problems with the media, just like moving to any other medium. And you're just, it's like taking a comic to a movie. There's certain things that are going to happen. It's the same thing. You take a print comic to a digital comic. There's some things that are just inherent with the medium that you got to learn.
That's true. But the biggest thing about Mark Waid is Mark Waid is well known because of his name and the work he did, which is, you know, his whole body work is most of it's phenomenal. I'm trying to think of a bad thing he did, and I can't think of anything bad, but I know every writer has a bad day. But it's just, you know, he's also a great guy. He's not going to be one of these guys who's just going to be like, ah, oh, mine now. He's not going to be like that.
Right, and the fact that he's gone over, as I said, going over to people who have been in the webcomic industry for a while now and asking their advice, I mean, that shows that he's not coming in with an ego like, well, as big as Kurtz's, saying, well, I'm going to go through, I'm going to take over, I'm going to do this all on my own, and it's going to be the best thing you've ever seen. Nobody else has done anything like this. He's saying, absolutely, I've got things to learn.
And that's the best thing he can do, and it's because he's not coming in telling Kaufman how to do his own business. He's coming in saying, look, I'm new to this, I want to break into this too, how do I do it?
Yeah, which is, you know, like that's, it's the same as any other, you know, as, yeah, sure, he's walking in here with all these great credentials and, you know, at least he's having the sense to go, hey, you guys have been doing this for a long time. How is the best way to go about doing this? And there's nothing wrong with sharing that and getting him where we are. We struggled for faster. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's not like, you know, in print comics where everybody has a limited budget, you know, there's a limited audience that's going to be able to buy comics on every given month. It's not like that in web comics. It's not like my audience is suddenly going to vanish on account of the fact that there's this new Thread Bent thing. You know, there's it's not going to happen. So it's not like suddenly our audiences are going to dry up or something. So what's the fuss?
Absolutely. And as we mentioned, we talked about last week when we talked about the opening of Thrill Bent, I took a look over there and I was astounded because I honestly, knowing Mark Waid's work, I was expecting, like so many of us have done, comic books on the web. Yeah, and I, you know, having several pages out, forming the short story, and as he has even said himself, I mean, it's a different pacing of writing. You know, rather than being able to put out 20 some pages to form a story, you have the how you're going to release it, how you're going to pace it, and he's taken that and made it something to where it is a distinct art form made for the media, where it was actually not just paced out, but using some of the tricks that you can only do on the web, that you cannot do in print, that you cannot do in television. It is a web medium.
Which is great, because then, you know, it helps to, you know, be able to tell people, it's like, okay, this is what the difference is.
Yeah, and it also just, you know, any talent we can bring into webcomics, doesn't matter who they are, you know, if you wish upon a star, it doesn't matter if they're from the print, it doesn't matter if they're animators, it doesn't matter who they are. If they want to come into this industry, you know, it brings more talent. Talent brings more talent. That's just all there is to it. If there's like one guy who's great, that will bring in more people who say, wow, I want to be as good as this guy.
Well, it also brings a general more awareness. I mean, hell, look, The Economist suddenly realizes that there are webcomics. I mean, hello. There's a, you know, there's a whole group of people who are, you know, in a certain age graph, you know, demographic that, you know, that's, you know, they're going to suddenly discover that, oh my God, they've put comics on the web, you know, like there's just, there are a lot of people who still don't recognize the fact that there are comics on the web. And yes, you can go and read them. Oh my God, for free.
Most of them, unless they're people with paywalls, but we don't talk about those guys.
Hey, whatever works to help fund the thing. Yeah. Absolutely. It really is. When you talk about, if you look in the general mass media and say, hey, there's an article from Scott Kurtz, and people are going to be going, who?
Yeah.
But for people who are in the industry, not in the webcomic industry, the print industry, people who read comic books, who read regular books, and they say, oh, there's an interview with Mark Waid about him doing something on the web, a huge number of people are going to have their ears perk up. And they're going to be paying attention to it and saying, hey, this is great. I wonder if there's anything else like it out there. And this is where our advertising, this is where the buzz and the word of mouth, this is, like I said, it's not a zero sum game. It's not just taking a bigger piece of the pie. I think Mark Waid and his introduction of Thrillbent and his getting into the webcomic industry is helping make a bigger pie.
Yeah, it's going to make more pie because there's no such thing as a finite number of audience in the web. There's plenty for everyone. And if people are talking about being scared, then they're scared because of their own shortcomings, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I just don't see why, you know, like, and he's like, Scott Kurtz is going like, wait, watch out, they're coming. And it's like, and how is this a bad thing? Mm-hmm. Like, why should we be scared? It's not like our audience is just going to all screw off and leave us, you know, and say, no, now we have something made by professionals. We're never going to read this stuff anymore. Like, they're not going to do that. It's just
People read comics regardless of quality all the time. I mean, my current read list is of varying qualities. I mean, let's see here. Of course, I read The Girl Genius by Phil Folio. I read SCBY by Kitty Hawk. I read two comics by Giselle Lagasse, who is also a professional comic book.
She's doing professional work for Archie.
Exactly. And so there's
It really is. There is, and to me, it's a bit hypocritical for someone who has been, and I'll say battling, talking about keeping the rights of your ownership of your properties, like Kurtz has, for ill or for good, and then to go around saying, well, be careful of the big names coming in here. No, welcome him with open arms. I completely intend to, and next time I see Mark Waid, I'm going to be welcoming him to the webcomic industry like so many others. But let's go ahead and go on to our next topic of discussion, and that is about Shifty Look lining up webcomic stars for Dig Dug. First of all, I mean, it's really been 30 years since Dig Dug came out. Wow. We've talked about, again, Shifty Look, we've talked about before because it's Bandai Namco's recreating a lot of their older properties as webcomics in a way to revitalize the brand. And as announced on their podcast, they're doing Dig Dug. And the list of people they have doing it, I mean, there are going to be some names out there that people are going to recognize. They have Scott Kurtz. Yeah. They have Randy Mulholland. They've got Matt Moylan, who's also who not only does Little Formers, but also does Shifty Look's Bravo Man. They've got Gabe and Tycho, for heaven's sake. Chris Staub. One of the names they've got in there, they've got Marv Wolfman.
Wow.
So, yeah, this is not a fly-by-night thing. This is a lot of things. And again, this is one of those things to me that's bringing a lot of attention to those in the webcomic industry. I mean, this is a major industry outside of the publishing industry. This is video games and electronic games.
And I just have one worry, which it's anyone who's old enough would remember the Saturday Supercade, which is where several video game properties were adapted for cartoon format. It was you had Frogger as an ace reporter. You had I'll let Tom regale you with the rest of the tales. I've only seen bits and pieces of the Saturday Supercade, but I've seen enough.
Granted, the 80s were video games were hot, very hot at the time. It was the peak time for video games where we had cartoons based on Pac-Man, cartoons based on Space Ace and Dragon's Lair, cartoons based on Q-Bert, and of course Mario, Donkey Kong and Mario and so many others. Yeah, it was Well, it was the 80s.
Yeah, the biggest problem, is lots of these old games, like Dig Dug especially, is one of these where there's not that much plot. It's mostly just, you know, move these graphics around on a mostly black screen and get stuff done. That was the plot, so to speak, of these early games.
However, and I do have to mention, because during the same time in the 80s, DC had their parent company had another company. They were DC's parent company, Warner Brothers, also were the owners of Atari. And they had a marvelous series out called Atari Force, which started off as a couple of comic books, many comic books that were included in some of the games that you bought from Atari, and spun off into a regular comic book series. Very well done. Very interesting characters. And it wasn't Pac-Man. It was original characters, original creations, original settings using Atari. So I honestly think that, again, this is a great thing. It's more to the party.
I'll give it a chance. I'll give you that much. I like I said, I'm just remembering Ace Reporter Frogger.
Well, I mean, at the article over at bleedingcool.com, they've got a little sample of some of the stuff. They've got a sneak peek of the Dig Dug work from Javier Charo. My heavens, that's beautiful work.
I've been seeing stuff pop up for this stuff. I watch the Udon Creative Collaborate. They're like a artist studio, I guess. And they've been putting stuff up for this for a while. And I've just been kind of like both amused and amazed at the quality of this work that's going up. Like just the interpretations, the sheer variance of interpretations. And I don't know, I think it's actually kind of a really interesting way for a video game company to try to revitalize some interest in their properties before like potentially looking at other games or ways of revitalizing them as games. Sort of like testing the waters in a less expensive format than actually developing a game and then sticking it out there, seeing it fail colossally. But it's like, you know, in this, they could see which ones, you know, really take off and which ones are really hitting their mark, and they can make some financial decisions based on that.
Exactly. I'm taking a look at some of this. I'm over at shiftylook.com right now. And some of the things they've got, not just Dig Dug, which is coming up, but I mean, they've got Scar, which is based off of one of the ninja style games. Alien Confidential. They've got something based off of Xevious, which I mean, lots of potential there. Sky Kid. I mean, my heavens, that's an old system. Rapid Thunder, which is actually the Rolling Thunder arcade games, both 1 and 2. Matt Moylan, like I said, Little Formers, is doing Bravo Man, doing merit for that, and doing it in a dice cartoony style. So, I mean, they are, some of it's hit, some of it's miss, as a lot of comics are out there, but I think this is a great bit on there, and I'm really looking forward to all the work that's being done for Dig Dug.
I'm just interested to see where this whole thing goes in general.
Absolutely, absolutely. But next up, the 2012 Joe Shuster Awards for Canadian creators. Both artists and writers and editors and everybody else in the Canadian comics, named after one of the creators of Superman who originally came from Canada. There was a huge list of nominees, and the fact that it includes webcomic creators and creative teams is phenomenal. And I especially after mentioning Thrillbent and Mark Waid, one of the people listed on here I notice is Ty Templeton, who's also been a long time professional print comic person.
There's a lot of talent in Canada, although most people never know it.
I played Doug and Bob McKenzie. You know, yeah.
I'm looking at the list of nominees. It's like, you know, in that for most of it, like I'm not very familiar with most of these folk, but I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the Canadian market that, you know, never really sees broad publication. So
the
Canadian, like, you know, I wouldn't say, I think that was a bad way of putting it, but there's,
you say the Canadian market, I picture a place where you could pick up maple syrup.
Yeah, that persists, but I meant like the Canadian talent market more so than, you know, like there's like a lot of talent up here that never really gets a lot of national or beyond even like international recognition. Like there's a lot of things going on up here that you would not know was Canadian unless somebody slapped you in the face with it. That's probably why most people probably don't even know what these awards are. It's kind of like the Junos. Nobody cares because it's Canadian. But yeah.
To me, it also shows, I mean, because I know that with some of the webcomics that I work on or work with, it's an international thing. I mean, it's breaking the barriers out there. And just because they're being created in Canada, I mean, I'm sure they've got a huge following down here and across the world.
Well, I mean, a lot of these are not, you know, they're not little, you know, little things. There's like Wolverine and Jubilee. There's, you know, the holiday special from Marvel Comics. There's Astonishing X-Men, X-Men Earth's Mutant Heroes. There's like a lot of Marvel titles. There's a lot of other titles that are just DC titles on here. Like they're probably titles that people have read, but they have no idea that there was a, you know, a Canadian artist or writer or artist writer team or whatever that actually was responsible for bringing that product to the light of day.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of the names on here. Some of the people that I recognize, I did not know were Canadian. I mean, I see Darwin Cook on there, Chester Brown, Ty Templeton. And it's amazing, not just that, not that it's a Canadian thing for Canadians, but like a lot of other ones. I mean, I'm still astounded and pleased as punch that they're including webcomics in as a category. Our discussion as to how it should be broken up from beyond that is a different thing, but it is a great way of paying attention and drawing out attention to webcomics again.
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely. I'm glad that, you know, we're recognizing that, you know, the web and people, digital comics and all that jazz. I'm actually kind of interesting. The fact that they actually include, they honor comic book retailers. That's kind of neat. And actually, one of them is in Vancouver, BC, that I'm aware of, that is actually extraordinarily supportive of independent comics.
That's
Golden
good.
Age collectibles here in Vancouver, BC. They are a great bunch.
So you're Canadian?
I am, yes.
Okay, say about.
About.
Darn it.
You want me to say a boot, don't you?
Just a little bit.
Just a little? Okay, you'll have to just keep listening to me and catch me on it, because I know that I do have other American friends who've caught me saying it from time to time.
Hey, I'm just disappointed that I haven't heard one A or any reference to back bacon out of the whole thing.
Well, you know what? I always say the next time they have Wolverine in anything, they have to make him speak with an authentic Canadian accent and say a boot and a.
I don't know.
They have to. I would love a Wolverine to talk like that.
Hey, as soon as they meet a Frenchman who actually says zut alors, I'll go for the A. And
I actually had French teachers who said that. Zut alors.
But next up on our list, what else? We're going to do a number of discussions about the story, the big story, the Avengers. We're going to talk first over at beacon.wharton.upenn.edu, the University of Pennsylvania, where they have a story about the mass marketing and evolution of the narrative structure using the Avengers as a primary story. This particular one is primarily talking about the buildup that Marvel has done, which is something that has not been done in movies. It's usually movie sequel. The Marvel movies, the recent ones, had done something which has never been done in the movies before, to my knowledge, where it's been had the cross-pollination of the end of Iron Man having the little bit after the credits with Nick Fury wanting to talk about the Avengers initiative, to the building up with Iron Man 2 with Hulk, and the little bits which all led up to the Avengers. Is the Avengers really the culmination of this, or is it really just the next stepping stone, and is it a way that movies are going to be progressing to where they can look at not just having movie sequel, like they did with Harry Potter or the Bourne movies or Indiana Jones, James Bond, but rather having a stable of movies and having little bits sharing from it to create a wider universe.
I think that definitely is the evolution, at least what Marvel's going to keep doing. It's such a shame that they really don't have Spider-Man anymore, because if they did, they totally would have thrown something in there. I have friends that insist that you can see Spider-Man in one of the shield monitors if you look really carefully, really quickly. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, but you can see Galaga in one too, so.
Hey, Galaga, they sort of kept on for a while. I miss my Galaga.
I think that the big question is going to be not so much as like they obviously proven that it's a great way to do it, and it kind of harkens back to actual old school comic, you know, storytelling with a lot of, you know, there was a lot of a crossover, and you know, there could be foreshadowing of things going on before the main storyline actually happened in other books and crossovers and yada yada. But the big question is going to be how they handle copyright. Possession of rights to make movies and stuff. I mean, that's why things like the Fantastic Four and that Spider-Man couldn't occur in these movies, because other people are holding on to the rights for the movies at the moment.
Right, I believe Universal owns the rights to Fantastic Four and X-Men, which is why they won't have any of the X-Men in the movie as well. Sony, of course, has Spider-Man, and they're not going to be letting that go for a long time.
Well, personally, I think that this kind of backhandedly helps, because you don't want to throw too many ingredients in the stew at first, because even as a comic book reader, the idea of you have a New York City where 99% of the superhero population live, yet they still have an insanely high crime rate, still doesn't sit right with me.
Well, that's just because everybody likes to set everything in New York.
Well, that's because that's where the artists lived. And what they draw what they look out the window and see.
And that really goes back to, because Marvel said that. Remember, before Marvel started doing that, I mean, it was Gotham City, it was Metropolis, it was Central City, it was Keystone City, it was made-up city of the earth, Coast City. Made-up cities where they didn't have to have references and where the skyline changed all the time.
And one thing that interests me is just as a slight tangent with DC, Metropolis and Gotham City were actually old nicknames for New York. Before the 20s and such, like New York was called the Gotham City and the Metropolis. So just little factoid from history and stuff.
Exactly. But it did go through. I mean, whether it was Stan Lee or Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko or whoever, Marvel said something by adding that extra little bit of realism to the comic book, not just in the storytelling, but in the placement of it. Now, but with the movies, I honestly see this being both a good thing and a bad thing, because we're going to be seeing, I mean, Marvel has proven that this is how the cross-pollinization works. And they did it right. Just little tidbits here and there. Some little Easter eggs that they put in there to where they see things. But we're also going to be seeing less talented hands attempting to do something like this.
And especially with one character sort of tying everything together. It wasn't necessarily Nick Fury. It was always Agent Coulson. And fans love Agent Coulson.
Well, it was nice too that it wasn't like a big showboating character. I think that's what people really liked, is that there's this very understated normal guy who was just an agent.
But even though he's a normal guy, he treats anything. You know, the freaking destroyer comes out from Asgard. He treats it like, oh, business as usual. Give me the microphone.
They had shown the other side of him too in the Avengers, where he's an absolute fanboy for Captain America.
And I love that about him. That's the one thing. It's like there's no one in the world that would hate Agent Coulson.
But I think he's so representative of the rest of us in some ways. You know, like he's the fanboy. He's the guy. He's out doing, you know, the best job he possibly can. He sees weird stuff every day, you know, but, you know, he's still got to do his job at the end of the day. And that's sort of like the cool thing about him, is he's very identifiable. You know, that's more so, I say, than, you know, somebody who's like, you know, they did do very well trying to make the characters more, I guess, identifiable, and less, you know, kind of on a pedestal kind of thing, as some other characters can be like, you know, they all have their flaws. But he was really that sort of the everyman everybody could get behind, is like, yeah, he's my guy.
Right. He's the touchstone. I mean, I remember having discussions with some of my friends about the first Transformers movie. Why bother having Shia LaBeouf and some of the other humans in there? Because it's a lot more easy to identify with the humans in there than it is the big giant robots. Now, We will not talk about the second or third or other Transformer movies. But yeah, Agent Coulson, I mean, he wasn't a major role in this either. I mean, he wasn't going in and kicking butt with Captain America or Iron Man. Now, he was just, he was backstage. He was second character. He was a second banana. And yet was a major force in one of them. And I think that's part of what makes this. He was the common thread in all of them without disturbing the fabric of our tapestry of the storylines.
And I think it's just how they masterfully weaved it all together, you know, and they foreshadowed the other characters. They foreshadowed, you know, Hawkeye in Thor, and they foreshadowed the other characters throughout. And, you know, like they had in Iron Man 2, they had Black Widow, and, you know, they kind of had those other characters showing in like a secondary role, so that you kind of got used to them when they all came together. You didn't have to spend a lot of time on origins or why they're together or anything. You could just move right into the meat of the conflict and have them come together. And I mean, even at the beginning, it was kind of nice to see that, you know, like the Avengers Initiative had fallen through and that there wasn't the confidence for it. And they still had to manipulate things to get everybody to go together to actually do what they had to do. You know, it wasn't just, you know, magically come together because we say so. It's like, no, there's that human, you know, fiddling in the politicians and crap.
And what I especially love was this was the first time that the Hulk was done right, in my opinion. It's because, you know, people keep on going back to the TV series for inspiration. The second attempt at a Hulk movie especially did that. And this is the first time where I really felt it for the Hulk, where I especially like the parts with Banner and Stark because they're both the nerdy guys, but at the same time, you know, Tony Stark isn't above, you know, just poking Banner and seeing, you know, a little green yet? No.
Exactly. I love Tony. I just love him. He's a magnificent ass, but I love him.
That's exactly it. I mean, the characterization here, that, to me, that was the big thing about all the Marvel movies, all the movies under the Marvel banner. This is why I'm not including in Spider-Man, the X-Men movies, the Daredevil movie, definitely not Elektra, or any of the others. It was only the ones under the Marvel Studios banner. They had characters that you could, that felt like characters. You could walk down the street and meet someone like Steve Rogers, both before and after the change. You could meet somebody who's as obnoxious as Tony Stark. You could meet somebody who's as timid or as filled with rage as a Bruce Banner. These were people. And that was, to me, that was always one of the things that was indicative of the Marvel style, was they weren't just pictures on a page. They were characters. And here, these characters, we see them coming to life, living and breathing, and making something to where they had their foibles, they had their flaws, they had their good and bad points.
And they graded. Like, that was sort of an interesting thing, is like, you know, they did great. You know, they all had their own way of doing things. I loved Black Widow. I just loved the way that they showed how manipulative she was.
And what I especially liked was just that scene, you know, near the end, there's no artificial feeling of, okay, here they are all coming together, here they're ready. There's nothing artificial about that scene in my mind, because, and I've seen other versions of Avengers that does scenes like that where it's extremely artificial. I'm talking about you, Ultimate Avengers animated movie, direct to DVD, piece of bull.
Tell us what you really think about that, Ben. Yeah. It's not Super Friends where everybody gets along.
No.
Those are not going to be best friends. They have common interests. They may like each other, but I don't see any of them being best friends. They have almost no common interests. But the relation, with the exception of the relationship which they had shown between Banner and Stark, because they have that commonality, somebody who's as smart as Tony Stark in his own field.
What I especially liked was that scene at the end where they're all going to separate ways. Banner actually goes with Stark. It heavily implies he takes up his offer to do research for Stark.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We could sit here and gush about it. I mean,
and what I also loved is the fact that Stark was the only one who believed Banner was coming back.
Yeah.
I think it was also too, like, it was serious, but it didn't lose its humor. There was, you know, like, it wasn't all about just, you know, the actions and the blowing up. There was a lot of humor, and there was a lot of so much dimension to the action and the dialogue and what was going on between them that would just, it was taking you through this, you know, this tapestry of characters without ever feeling like you were being overwhelmed. Like, I've always found a lot of the movies that are based on the way that they do them generally, they're based on comic books. If they have more than like the main character and like one villain, you know, like this is like Spider-Man 3 being a point, you know, where they started to get like just too much going on. And it's like they didn't handle the characters in such a fashion that it was able to kind of weave all these larger than life personalities together in such a fashion that it actually works. Like, this is the only movie I have ever seen that manages to do that.
See, and to me, let's go ahead and contrast this with what is expected to be the other big blockbuster this summer, The Dark Knight Rises, to where Christopher Nolan with Batman Begins and The Dark Knight has taken on a completely different tact. Joss Whedon made a comic book film. That's a believable comic book film. With the exception of the Sam Raimi films, I don't think we've ever seen before. But Christopher Nolan, on the other hand, hasn't made a comic book movie. He's made a movie that just happens to feature a character that was created in the comic books. Are we going to see more stories? We already know that more people in Hollywood are taking a look at comic books and even webcomics as a source of inspiration, which means that, thank God, we may never see the Gilligan's Island movie.
Oh, God.
But the different tech, I mean, are we going to be seeing a battle royale between Avengers and Dark Knight Rises?
I don't know. I almost see them as completely different flavors. DC and Marvel as different flavors.
They really are. And then really, it's a really big case of it's way too late now for DC to try to do a unified movie universe. They had a chance, but they missed it. They lost the plot. And, you know, Nolan created a universe that's specifically Batman. He's working on a universe that's specifically Superman. There's no turning back now, because what Nolan's going to make is going to make DC money, and they're not going to derail it, you know, this late in the game, unless, you know, they're charged by an idiot, which they are. So never mind.
Well, you're talking singular, it's plural. And
well, they've already got they've got two strikes out of three in terms of like they've batted like, you know, really well with the Dark Knight trilogy. Like, the first one was amazing. The second one was amazing. And I don't think that, you know, at this late point in the game, you know, changing the third, you know, version, you know, to basically wrap it all up, because I mean, that's pretty much what it was set up to do.
Well, you know, not wrap it all up per se, but change what they're doing with the other movies. Bring, you know, regardless of what conclusion Dark Knight Rises has, just say, okay, we're going to bring back all the Batman characters that was in the Nolan film anyways, you know, and then bring back whoever's going to be Superman, Caviezel or whatever his name is, or whatever, bring back him back as Superman. Just make a JLA movie, just so we can, you know, compete against Avengers. You know, bring back Ryan Reynolds. I don't know why you would. As
well, they're already bringing him back for Green Lantern 2.
But are they really?
Movie bombed. That movie bombed so bad.
Deadpool.
That movie is number 11 in losing the most money in the history of cinema.
They've already got him slated for Green Lantern 2.
Oh, my God. How many people did Geoff Johns bleep to get that done?
Well, that's neither here nor there, because, I mean, when we talk about Justice League, DC had their opportunity. They missed the boat. But I don't think that without the right people in charge. I mean, say for war what you want. I mean, Avengers is a Joss Whedon film.
Oh, yes.
I don't think it would have been anywhere near as good if they had somebody else doing it. You could tell the Joss Whedon flavor all over
it. Good Joss Whedon, not evil Joss Whedon.
Yeah. No, it's definitely on the good side. And I don't think that there is like anybody else who could have weaved that together as masterfully as he did. But he's, you know, that's the sort of thing, that's kind of what he does, like, with characters. He does that.
Yeah.
Masterfully weaving of characters with all sorts of crazy flaws together, and this cohesive bind, you know, the way of dance almost, you know, and adding in all that humor and the witty dialogue. And I mean, I did notice that Tony's dialogue was even punchier this time around.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I was like, yeah, there's that Joss Whedon dialogue I was waiting for.
But I will say, I mean, there is one other director that immediately comes to mind who could have done it as good a job, if not better. And that's, I got, I'll honest to God, I cannot stand Tom Cruise. I think he's not a good actor. He's, I keep being reminded
Brad of Bird.
Line. Brad Bird, yes, as a director, who yes, also has it. That flavor of getting characters. And yeah. The way that he did Mission Impossible 4, to where it wasn't a Tom Cruise tour de force, it was an ensemble movie. And Tom Cruise's character in Mission Impossible 4 was the perfect spy. I mean, everything I do is right. And the others around him were interesting screw-ups. And I had more fun watching the others. And with Tom Cruise doing whatever the hell he wants to do, the others were the ones that made the movie. Brad Bird made that. Joss Whedon made Avengers. And I'm looking forward to him doing Avengers 2 or maybe even a Justice League movie. Just so long as they do not have the great actor David Ogden Stiers as the Martian Manhunter again.
I have seen some of the cartoons that they've done for the stuff lately, like the Batman Superman ones that they've been doing, that DC has been doing, and I do think there's some potential there.
No,
and I was like no, but actually I did like them. I just liked the interplay.
Batman with a battle axe against an army of doomsdays. I'm sorry,
no, not that one.
No, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about Justice League Crisis on Two Earths.
Oh, that's a different story. That's a horse of a different color.
Yeah, and I mean, unfortunately, some of that quality we're not going to be seeing because of the very premature death of Dwayne McDuffie.
Yeah, and it's also, like I said,
it's also, I mean, we're looking at Bruce Timm, who's in charge of animation over at DC and Warner Brothers. We're not going to be seeing them breaking them over to live action movies anytime soon. So a lot of the quality that they have on there isn't going to be coming through.
Yeah. It's Brad Bird was able to break into live action quite well and quite easily. I might add it's very few animation directors say I'm going to do live action. Then, you know, do something great with live action.
And a fairly big title at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's Brad freaking Bird. It's what happens when you gene splice, Walt Disney with, with Chuck Jones.
But there's also, we're looking at other comic book movies and other property movies coming out this year. I mean, we've got Dark Shadows, which...
That's based off of a 70s sitcom.
Well, a 70s drama, a soap opera. It's a soap opera, no way around it. It's a vampire soap opera long, long, long before this Twilight nonsense.
And I actually watched clips of it in the original Barnabas. Was so good of an actor that,
Jonathan Freed.
Yeah, he was such a great actor that watching Johnny Depp do this horrible, horrible thing with that character just makes me sick.
Yeah.
Because I didn't even
hear kind of went, okay, so we've got, what's his face? Jack Sparrow and Goth.
Okay. It's a Tim Burton movie. It has Johnny Depp in it. It has Helen, what's her name in it? And
Helena Bonham Carter, who's, involved with Burton. But I mean, we're looking at some of the other movies coming out too. I mean, Battleship, which looks like it's going to be a good popcorn flick.
You hopefully. Suck my Battleship. Yeah, so, Liam Neeson.
I've always said I expect this movie to be 10 minutes of a close up of Liam Neeson studying over everything that's going on. It gets closer. The sweat begins to pour down Neeson's face. And finally, he says, D6. But we're also looking at the amazing emo man, I mean Spider-Man coming out, which
try the Batman eyes Spider-Man
after Sam Raimi's trilogy, and I half include the third one because half of it was great, the other half the studio stuck their nose in.
And really, really, to me, the fact that the production crew for Amazing Spider-Man go out of their way, and I've read plenty of interviews where they go out of their way to say, well, unlike the Raimi films, we're doing this. Unlike the Raimi films, we're doing that. I'm like, shut up.
Yeah. It actually reminds me of one of your favorite whipping boys, that's the Batman cartoon versus Sam Batman the animated series, where they went through and they decided, well, we're going to do everything completely different. Sam Raimi made a beautiful set of films. This thing,
Yeah, that is.
Well, to me, it's the whole idea of, you know, they're casting Martin Sheen just for the name Martin Sheen, because Martin Sheen is not the right kind of person to play Uncle Ben.
Now, come on. You'd pay money to see Martin Sheen shot, wouldn't you?
Okay, that's geez, damn it.
Okay, and on that note, we're going to get and bring our show to a close today. I want to thank our guests and other hosts here. Well, we have no guests. Well, we've got our one guest, Ben Carver, the host of the Animation Aficionados podcast. Ben, where can they pick up your podcast at?
AnimationAficionados.com. Be sure to check us out. We're going to have several very great episodes coming up, including Gargoyles.
Nothing I'm going to say. And helping us with our news today is Alex Eberling from alexesguide.net, who had to leave early, couldn't be here for a discussion, but we're glad to always have Alex here. And, of course, our other regular, our new regular on here, Marie Terry from evilspacecat.com.
Yep, and I will try to do better with names next time. And my timing must work on timing. It's my homework.
And that leaves me. I'm your host, Thomas Rebore, over from 910 Comics. That's 910cmx.com. We'll be seeing you later, and we'll see you in the funny papers.